Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Welcome to Venus Rising. I'm Jennifer Law, and I'm excited about today's guest. I'm going to be speaking with Allison Motluck. And Allison is a freelance journalist who hails from Canada. And she's been doing journalism for over 20 years now. It's amazing how time flies. But she's quite an accomplished journalist, and I've been following her work for probably as long as she's been writing. And you can see her work in The Economist, The New Scientist, Globe and Mail, and she covers quite a broad array of issues. But most important and relevant to our listeners at Venus Rising is the writing and broadcasting she does in the area of the advances in assisted reproduction. She also has a weekly email newsletter that I'm sure we'll talk about, and you'll learn how to sign up for that, called Hey ReproTech. It's a pretty new newsletter, I think, and she keeps an eye on the world of reproductive technology. So, Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us. I appreciate your time. I know time is a precious commodity these days. So why don't we get started? And I'm just curious, as a freelance journalist who covers all kinds of issues, how and why did you get interested in assisted reproduction?
I got interested in assisted reproduction. I kind of pinpoint it back in 2005. I was already a science journalist, so I got in through the science. I was very interested in the science. I was at a meeting in Montreal, which was, if I recall, it was a joint ASRM and CFAS meeting, and I saw a poster that said something like, donor offspring are interested in meeting their sperm donors. And I would say that's the moment when I really started to get intensely interested. And the poster was by the Sperm Bank of California. And I was really interested in that idea. I had never thought of that before. Why would they be interested? So that was the beginning. And I was already a science journalist, but my interest started with donor offspring. And then I've kind of become interested in different aspects of reproductive technology and the fallout from reproductive technology since then, including egg donors and surrogates and sperm donors. And it's just a really interesting area that brings up questions that you don't immediately think about.
And for our listeners, the ASRM is in America, it's the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, which is sort of the governing professional body around all the physicians who practice in this space. And then the Canadian Andrology and Fertility, what does it stand for again? Yeah. Remind me.
The Canadian Fertility and Andrology Society, which is sort of a counterpart for the ASRM, although the ASRM is much larger and perhaps much more powerful.
Interesting. Why do you say that?
I think they're a much more coordinated organization that does much more public, maybe I could say lobbying, but the meeting is very, very large, and it's an international meeting. The ASRM meeting is an international meeting with a lot of people attend, even if they aren't Americans, because it's a kind of a leading place to learn about cutting edge science and a lot of ideas around reproductive technology.
And yeah, you're right. And they do quite a bit of lobbying here in the United States in particular. It's a lobbying arm. It's called Resolve. And, you know, they pop up at this various state levels because the U.S., we don't have any federal regulation around assisted reproduction like the Canadians do. So one of the things I really wanted to talk with you about is that, you know, all of assisted reproductive technology, well, maybe not all, a lot of assisted reproductive technology in Canada is regulated by your federal government. And you recently had a public inquiry comment period of time because they were going to reassess and reevaluate, and they have issued their report. What changed, and what changes were good, or what changes had you hoped for that weren't made?
Well, so, I mean, I find the Canadian situation really interesting because we do have a federal law. It's called the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, and it came into force in 2004. The interesting thing about the law is it says you cannot pay a surrogate to be a surrogate. You cannot pay a donor to donate their sperm or eggs or embryo. You may pay some expenses to those people, but only the expenses that we specify are okay. But the law did not go on to say what it specified was okay. And it was only this year, 15 years later, that they that they did that, that they actually created regulations to go along with this old law. So you can imagine in the 15 years in between, people kind of came to their own conclusions about what the law intended, and it ranged a lot. I mean, some people argued that the wording of the law made it clear you couldn't pay any expenses until the regulations came out and specified what those were. And then on the other end of the spectrum, people interpreted the law to mean anything that might even vaguely touch a surrogacy or an egg donation can be included as an expense, including things like my surrogate needs an oil change. And so that we'll include that as an expense and we'll pay her for that. And I guess I'll just say, because it might sound, this all might sound very odd to foreign ears, what was happening for 15 years in this country when, despite the fact that the law said you may not pay a surrogate or an egg donor or a sperm donor, people wanted to pay and they were finding ways to pay. I'm not saying everyone was paid, but a very significant portion of people participating were paying and being paid. And they were doing it by pretending that there were expenses, paying for those quote unquote expenses, but those expenses often were not real expenses, or they were not expenses related to a surrogacy or a donation.
Yeah. I remember being at a surrogacy conference. I believe it was in London. It's been several years ago now. And there was quite a large booth set up by a Canadian surrogacy agency. And the women that were manning the booth were most of them had been surrogates in the past and then sort of got into the business side of it. And they were talking about just even the fact that they could receive gifts.
They could. Right.
You know, like, thank you for having a baby for us. And those gifts could be monetary.
Well, so that actually adds another element. So the Canadian situation is also interesting because the federal law that we're talking about only, the government has made it clear I shouldn't say it makes it clear. People generally agree that it only applies to Canadians, so Canadian intended parents who are seeking surrogates. Part of the reason why Canada has become a really popular spot for foreigners to come, you know, people to come from all over the world come to Canada for surrogacy, part of the reason is that those people are allowed actually to pay, or at least they aren't going to be held to our law. So what the situation we have right now is that we don't know how many, but a large proportion of surrogacies taking place in Canada are actually for foreign couples, because surrogates will, I believe, choose to work with foreign couples because then it's uncomplicated that they can be paid. It's not as straightforward as in a place where it's openly legal, but it's certainly not as risky as to try to be paid by a Canadian in Canada.
Yeah.
This is starting to sound this sounds ridiculous as I hear myself speak. I think it's because it is kind of ridiculous. There's a federal law in Canada that says you may not pay. A large proportion of people participating want to pay and want to be paid. So that's the situation we are left with. What happened? You asked me what happened this year. And what happened was they wrote those regulations, and the regulations say fairly clearly, no, you may not create expenses that don't exist and then pay people pretending that those are expenses, but actually pay them. You can't do that. And they listed, you know, which sorts of things could be covered by expenses. And they are, you know, you can reimburse someone for their taxi ride to the appointment, or, you know, for maternity clothes if they're having twins, or for days of lost work if you're a surrogate. There are specific things, although the conversation that followed was, you know, a lot of us are wondering, how are they going to monitor that carefully? There aren't a lot of people who are going to be dedicated to checking out these receipts, and there do have to be receipts according to the regulations, but there aren't going to be a lot of people in government agencies in Health Canada who are going to be monitoring that's how it's done. And everyone's kind of aware of that. So most of us think not much is going to change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to you thinking, you know, from 2004 to now, and this is as good as it gets as far as trying to bring clarity or better protections or making sure that, you know, exploitation doesn't happen.
I'm not sure. There's not a lot of conversation around exploitation, which is interesting, because the original creators of the law were very, very concerned about exploitation. And I will say the law was drawn up, a long time ago, before surrogacy was actually, or egg donation and sperm donation were as popular and widespread as they are now. But I will say the lawmakers were very concerned about exploitation, but that is no longer, I don't think that's really part of the dialogue anymore. But it's sort of implied that part of why they don't want payment is to avoid exploitation. But no one's really talking in that language. They're not talking about why that might be a problem and what we would do about that. And just for the record, you and I have talked about this. I'm not against the idea of paying surrogates. I can imagine a world where it was done properly, where it would be better than what we have here in Canada, which is we do, by and large, pay surrogates, but we lie about it and we hide it all and everyone's nervous that they're going to be thrown in jail for doing it. Because that's the other part of the law, actually. It's not just that they say you can't pay surrogates or donors. You can't pay them, and if you're found to have done so, you could be thrown in jail for 10 years, or you could be charged a fine of up to $500,000. So it's, although that hasn't happened, it could happen. And so people are nervous. People like to do things in the shadows because they're nervous that if they did it openly, they could run up against the law.
Well, you've written one of your Hayri Pro Tech pieces was sort of on the industry, the money, the booming, growing industry. Do you even have an ability to put a dollar amount on how big this business is in Canada, this non-commercial business? Oh,
I actually can't. In Canada, I honestly don't know. In fact, our statistics are so poor. I can't really tell you how many surrogacies there are each year. I definitely can't tell you how many. So surrogacies can be either what they call gestational surrogacies. That's when you're using embryos. That's when a surrogate is using embryos that aren't related to her, versus what they call traditional surrogacies, where a woman is using her own eggs. I can't tell you what the proportion is in this country. Everyone's guessing, but I've heard that the traditional might actually be rising at the moment, which I find really interesting. But I have no way of finding out how many. I don't know what the industry's worth. I don't know what the average fertility doctor earns. I don't know anything really about the size of the Canadian industry. I can't tell you how many of the surrogacies here are for foreigners. I can't tell you how much money is made per each surrogacy. We have a very, very poor system for keeping track of this kind of data. The best data we have is collected by the Canadian Fertility and Andrology Society. And of course, they have data that they also don't make public. And so I would love to see really good record keeping in Canada and that data all public and open to academics to do research on. We need that desperately.
Yeah, that sounds very similar to here in the U.S. as far as the data and the tracking and getting a handle on how much of this is going on. You said that you hear that traditional surrogacy is on the rise. That's intriguing to me. Why is that?
No, I mean, I heard that. I can't verify that.
Okay. Because if anything, in the U.S., it's moving really far away from that model. It's more the gestational surrogacy model. Interesting. Well,
I say that what I actually intended, what I meant was, yes, it's true that gestational is the dominant model and almost all surrogacies are gestational. But I've heard that in the last couple of years, there's been an increase in traditional. And I suspect it might have something to do with money, that it's a lot easier to do and cheaper. Yeah. And you can just do it with a lot less hassle when you're not including a fertility clinic. So that's just a rumor I heard, which I found interesting. And the point being, I have no way of verifying this. We don't keep records. And I will say, I think the U.S. is better at keeping records than Canada. I think the CDC at least keeps some numbers, and I think they do a better job than we do here.
Well, that's interesting. And how does it work? Like when a surrogate gives birth in Canada, does her name go on the birth certificate? And then is there an adoption process, or does her name never even go on the birth certificate like commonly happens in the States?
So as in the States, this it depends on the jurisdiction. So depending on the province, the process will be different. There are provinces where the surrogate's name will go on the birth certificate and then it has to be removed either through adoption or some other process. But I believe there is one or two provinces have a situation where they make these arrangements before the birth certificate is ever issued. And so the surrogate's name never goes on the birth certificate. And for the record, I'm a person who believes in accurate record keeping. And so as you know, birth certificates are records of birth, I believe I personally would like to see birth certificates reflect everything accurately. I'm not saying that the general public should be able to see everybody else's birth certificate, but it should be on record accurately. So to me, obviously, we want to know who the legal parents are. Those are the parents who are the parents. And those people, and in certain provinces here, we can have up to four legal parents. I totally understand that they need to be on the birth certificate. But I think we also probably should have the egg donor should be named, is I think, and the sperm donor. If not named, then at least their donor number should be there. A surrogate should probably be named. And there are other reproductive techniques that maybe mean that we should be naming other people. These things might become important in the future, and the offspring may want to know, may need to know for medical reasons. And I don't think it's a good idea to have official documents that don't reflect what's actually going on.
Yeah, and that gets me back to your kind of opening of how you sort of got interested in this was, you know, sort of becoming aware of this whole anonymous, you know, donor conceived community of people out there that have been working, you know, for a long time. So several of your recent pieces that you've written, should one surrogate be told about the others, an anonymous sperm donor being found, you know, this sort of deals with the secret anonymity of it. You want to talk a little bit about those two pieces that, you know, sort of raise the issue of should people know what's going on and who's doing what?
So the one that you mentioned about the sperm donor being found, this, it's funny because this was a communication I had years ago during, while I was writing an article about, Googling your donor, your child's donor, and what do you do when you might even accidentally find them, you know, what do you do? So, but at that time I had interviewed a number of sperm donors and I wasn't able to put that information into that article at the time, but one letter really stuck with me, and it was from a donor who pointed out that, you know, he'd never really thought about his offspring. But then once a mother contacted him, he found he couldn't stop thinking about the offspring. He wanted to know who the offspring was. He wanted to meet that person and make sure that she was okay. But he didn't have that opportunity. So the mother had contacted him and wanted to get information, got, you know, details about his family and so on, photographs, and then didn't reciprocate by letting him know that this offspring that was brought into the world was okay and happy, and it didn't give him an opportunity to act on what he called, you know, his reactivated feelings or his activated feelings. So I thought that was really interesting because we always hear about sperm donors not caring. I haven't found that to be universally true. I think a lot of sperm donors, when they find out they have offspring, have very interesting and complex feelings. They may not have thought about it, but that doesn't mean it wasn't important to them. And I think sperm donors are a group that we haven't really, maybe we haven't talked to enough. We've assumed things about them, but we haven't actually heard from them about how they feel about having these offspring that they may or may not be able to have any contact with. So that was the simultaneous surrogacy one was really interesting to me because a surrogate brought this to me and said, you know, I was really bummed out. I had been asked to be a surrogate. We talked to each other. I chose this family out of many, many families who were interested in working with me. I thought we were friends, and we went ahead and she had a miscarriage. And while she was recovering from the miscarriage, the family emailed her and said, oh, you know, we might be looking for someone else. And she's like, what are you going to replace me? And they said, oh, no, just, you know, in case we want a second child down the road. And you know how long these things take. They reassured her that they weren't going to do anything right away. So she went ahead and tried again and did conceive and carried the child to term and gave birth to the child. And the parents were in the room when the child was born. And everyone was very happy about that. And they posted a picture of the child on Instagram. And a month later, they posted the picture of two other children on Instagram. And it turns out that they had actually worked with another surrogate at the same time. And they had two other children. So now they had three children by two surrogates, but the surrogates had not been told about each other. And I found this fascinating that this very intimate project you're working on together that you wouldn't tell this surrogate what was happening. And so I basically that piece, which was the piece I actually launched the newsletter with last year in September, I wanted to know, like, how do professionals in the field feel about this? Like, what do lawyers say about this? What do agencies say about this? What do doctors say about this? Like, is that okay to not tell people? And really the opinions were divided, but it was interesting to me. It's one of those examples of this field it brings up so many interesting questions. And I will say a lot of people are doing simultaneous surrogacies right now, because even here in Canada, our agency, one of the larger agencies here, told me that she had 40 couples working at that time when I talked to her on simultaneous with two separate surrogates at the same time.
Wow. And are they intentionally trying to have the children born close together so that they're sort of kind of like raising twins?
I guess, although, I mean, I have two children, I would recommend to anyone to separate them, you know, don't have them at the same time, because two children, each child is very, very difficult. You know, they're difficult, they're challenging. You want to have all the time you possibly could. But that's just my personal experience. I can't imagine why I would want to have like multiple children all born at the same time by design, you know, and then also to be working with two individuals who also are people, you know, and need to have a relationship with you, possibly. So I was surprised. But yes, apparently it is very popular now. I mean, the upside of that is that I think that part of the reason it's popular is that people don't want to have, they want to avoid multiple pregnancies, that is twins, triplets, and higher, because of the health implications of multiples, which I think is a good idea. But I also think I'm surprised that people still want to have multiple children all born at the same time.
And do you sense that in Canada that it's similar to here in the US, where it's the more affluent wealthy that are accessing, buying, purchasing, and lower income women? I don't really know the economics of this, how and how it plays out in Canada.
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. Certainly the people who created our law were very, very concerned about this income differential. And, you know, obviously you can't be poor and be going about commissioning a surrogacy, because surrogacy is expensive. But I did find a few years ago, I interviewed several surrogates across the country. And I would say, I don't believe that they are like lower income. And actually, someone has done a study looking at incomes of surrogates across Canada, a sample. They don't tend to be low income women. They tend to be modest income women. So I don't think that the exploitation that was feared by the lawmakers has actually come to play in general here. But again, I would love to know, have even more data on this, because I think it's an interesting question.
You wrote one piece on embryo donation. How many embryos do you guys have frozen up there? We have like a million in the US. Is this sort of a new phenomenon of, you know, these setting up embryo donation agencies?
Well, so yeah, we have a lot of, we have the same issue as in the US, which is, what do we do with these embryos? You know, they're not nothing, right? There's something. They could have been my offspring. They could have been my child, and just so happened they aren't. But could potentially, you know, it feels like it's something that could have been my own child. So there's all this conflicted feeling about what to do with embryos that are frozen. Clinics. My understanding is that clinics occasionally, you know, with the consent of parents, will donate those embryos to parents. But this particular, the couple I wrote about were working through an agency that's specifically, it has a kind of a different way of working. It requires the two families to meet and get along, and, you know, it has to be open. It can't be anonymous. Whereas the clinics, as I understand it, all of the clinics in Canada have, anyone who does embryo donation does it anonymously. That's an understanding. I haven't verified that, but that's what I've been told. But this particular agency required that it not be anonymous. So the couples have to meet, they have to agree on how it's going to work, what their arrangement's going to be. Will they know each other? How will they know each other? How will their children know each other? How will they integrate their lives? To what extent will they integrate their lives? And so that was what I found interesting about that. I don't remember now how many they said they dealt with. It wasn't a high number, but it was an interesting model, because it did recognize that there could be a special bond between the two, between the offspring, you know, born to one family and another family. They are full siblings. siblings.
So you've been at this for 20 years. Well, I guess 2005, you said, was when you, you know, attended that conference and started getting your interest peaked. You know, what's your perspective now? Are we getting things right? Are we dealing with things, you know, seriously as I think we should be dealing with them? Or are you hopeful or fearful?
Yeah. What do I feel? I feel, I should have an answer to that, of course. No, I wouldn't say I feel hopeful particularly. I wouldn't say I'm a little bit fearful. I mean, on the one hand, I'm going to say, and again, you know, you and I have spoken about these things. We don't always agree, but we agree to disagree. I mean, I'm really happy that families that really want to have children are able through reproductive technology to have children. I'm very, very happy about that. I am happy that gay couples who in the past could never have had children can now have children with these techniques. That I'm really glad about that. I guess what worries me is that there are still things happening that make me really nervous about the way some surrogates are treated, or the way egg donors are treated, the way their health is sometimes put on the side. And I mean, I don't think it's deliberate, but it is happening. And that worries me. It worries. There's just a lot of motion in this field of medicine, and not a lot of thinking about how we're doing it. So I guess I'm not really hopeful.
I worry about things like the whole artificial wombs that are coming, and synthetic egg and sperm, and will we even be needed anymore? I mean, I'm in the backyard of Stanford University, and Hank Greeley wrote several years ago his book, you know, The End of Sex, where he.
Right.
This really, you know, declarative statement about, you know, 50 years, all babies will be made in the lab and, you know, Western countries and that, you know, we'll just, you know, move into this sort of manufacturing of perfect designer children. And
I mean, all of these things worry me, and what worry, but I'm not, it's not that I think, I mean, I don't think this is the end of naturally conceived children. I mean, I don't worry so much about that. And I'm also mindful that so many of these technologies are good. They do end up bringing real advances that are good advances. I don't want to downplay that, but it does worry me how things change without us thinking much about it. Like, you know, the whole genetic screening of embryos, it's very problematic. I mean, on the one hand, it's terrific if you have an illness that you're trying to avoid passing on to your offspring, or, you know, there's certain traits that are for health reasons or other reasons you can't, you know, I get that. But it just seems like there's also this concern that we aren't willing to discuss how this should all work. Like, at what point do we say, no, you know, humans are just naturally flawed people. Like, you know, I wrote a piece, you know, about, it was based on a book called Choosing Down Syndrome. And that book really made me think, you know, where do we draw the line? Women in Canada are referred all the time to have testing to see if their fetuses might have Down syndrome. And the book really made me think about what that actually meant, you know, what it actually meant that the state actually felt that encourages women, and I was one of them, you know, to have Down syndrome testing. And it was, it's illuminating to ask yourself, like, what traits do your own children who you love right now have that someday someone might say, that's something we should screen out, you know? And that's what I think, like, what children are just as imperfect as anyone else's children. And I want them. I love them. People are imperfect. People are imperfect, all of us, and we'll never have a perfect human being. And that's the part that worries me the most, I think, is this pursuit of perfectionism. We can't create perfect children, and we shouldn't want to.
No, and I know for myself, I remember my last pregnancy. I was 35, and I was immediately put into this high-risk category because of maternal age. And I thought, for heaven's sakes, it's not like I have a foot in the grave here. And there was just a lot of fear that I sort of felt was coming at me. I should, because of my age, I should have all this testing and this kind of hand-wringing and worrying about preventing and avoiding. And I just wanted to be excited I was pregnant. And I was a nurse, so I was really well-informed, and a pediatric critical care nurse. So I sort of knew, you know, what kind of children could be born. But I just think that there's a lot more sort of push in that direction, societal, and as well as from the medical community, to have, you know, to have a hiccup-free labor and delivery pregnancy experience with a perfect baby at the end, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of perfect babies, let's talk about one of the most controversial and interesting convoluted cases I've heard of, and that was Jessica Allen. And you did a brilliant documentary, sort of documenting her story. And I still remember sitting in the office when I got a phone call from her and her husband. And I remember having to ask them about three times to explain what had happened, because I was like, what? what happened? And immediately went to the computer and Googled superfoetation, and, you know, the phenomenon where a woman who's already pregnant can get pregnant again.
So, right, yeah. I mean, I also did not believe that story. I did not believe that what she said happened had actually happened. What she said happened was that she was a surrogate, a single embryo had been transferred to her uterus, but that somehow she had conceived her own child on the side and gave birth to two children who were assumed to have been the product of a split single embryo. Both were handed over to the intended parents, and subsequently people figured out that those were not genetically related offspring, and that one of them was her naturally conceived child. I didn't believe that, but that is in fact what happened. And actually, I don't want to take too much credit for that documentary, because those two parents told their story so, so, so well. It was a heartbreaking story. Subsequent to that, I found, because everyone, you Googled superfoetation, everyone I spoke to said, this never happens. I can't even believe how could it have happened? It's so rare. It just, you know, but in fact, it's not, I'm not sure it's that rare. Well, it's rare, but I don't know that it's so rare that they should have been discounting it. A paper came out just after my documentary came out. I believe it was a paper came out, and it wasn't the only three papers came out in the last couple of years, which showed that, in fact, it's occasionally happens that women undergoing IVF have conceptions on the side, unintended natural conceptions, in addition to the embryos that they have, or the embryo that they have transferred. And this isn't a huge deal if you're going through your own pregnancy and you're looking to have children. So you have one embryo transferred, you naturally conceive another child on the side. I mean, you can be happy about that. You wanted children and now you have children. Mm-hmm. It's a different situation if you're a surrogate and you're carrying an embryo to hand over to somebody else, and especially in the case of in Jessica's case, you know, she was carrying an embryo that was not related to her, and it was related to the parents, and it was, as a baby, was handed over to the parents. She handed her own child accidentally over to this other couple. I mean, if this happens even one time a year, that's a lot of times. And I mean, the statistics suggest that it could be happening one time a year, or one time every 10 years, or more than not happening at all, which is a lot to accidentally hand over your own offspring to a parent who's looking for their own offspring. It you know, Jessica Allen said herself, she thinks it's time we start DNA testing offspring born to surrogates, just so that this never happens to anyone again upon their birth.
Yeah, and in her case, it was only picked up because of the mixed race, you know, component of this arrangement. You know, she was carrying a Chinese couple's baby, and Jessica's white, and her husband's African American. So how many times does this happen in the labor and delivery room, and two babies are handed over to intended parents, and because there's no mixed race element going on, people just go, oh, you know, here's your two babies. Or
well, I mean, it's a question, although I'm not trying to argue that it happens all the time, it's a question, you know, that if it ever happens, we need to be, and it has just happened, it has happened, we know in her case, we have to be more cautious. In fact, I think it would have taken even longer for them to recognize it, that it came up, it was flagged because that couple was from China and needed to take their children home. And in order to get passports, they had to have genetic tests. And when they had the genetic tests, it was revealed that one child was not related to them. So it could have taken even longer if they were just looking at the children themselves, even though they were different races. I think it would have taken even longer without that genetic test. It's it's sobering. I think there could be a couple of children who believe they, you know, who are going to find out that they were related to their surrogate.
Yeah, and now with so many people fascinated with DNA testing just for their own, you know, just interest, I mean, 10, 15 years from now, you can imagine people DNA testing and going, oh, we're not really brothers and sisters. I thought you were my... You know, so it will be interesting to see how this plays out in the next decade or so as, you know, people for their own curiosity just do their own genetic testing.
Yeah. They're doing, I mean, that's happening every day on, there's a Facebook group called DNA Detectives, and every day people are making those discoveries already. So yeah, in 10 years, it's going to be, it's just, you know, we talked earlier on about anonymity. Anonymity is not possible anymore. And so we should stop saying that it is. It's not possible. No one should be led to believe that they can keep this kind of relationship private. Your child will know. Your child can know now, and in the future, it'll be even easier.
Where can our listeners find that documentary if they want to watch it?
So I don't have the exact URL, although I can give it to you afterwards, but it aired on CBC Radio, that's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation here, on a program called The Current, and I believe it was called Expecting the Unexpected.
Yeah. We'll definitely put a link when we... you know, when we release this episode. And how can our listeners get on your Hey ReproTech email newsletter list? I know you're on Twitter at Hey ReproTech.
Although I'm not as active there as I ought to be. If anyone was interested, and I'll say it's free to anyone. You're welcome to become a paying subscriber, but at the moment the content is the same whether you're a paying subscriber or just a free sign up. And it's, if you Google Hey ReproTech one word, that's Hey H-E-Y and then ReproTech R-E-P-R-O-T-E-C-H, it should come up. But it's, if you want it, the actual URL would be that word, heyreprotech.substack.com. But it should come up first to reference upon a search.
Good. Well, and we'll be sure to include that link as well. So, Allison, thank you so much. It's been just a pleasure to talk with you and learn more about you and your work. And I look forward to following you on Hey ReproTech.
Thank you very much. Nice talking with you.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.